pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that everybody said would be a widowmaker. An airplane so hard to fly that the men who trained on it had a saying. One a day in Tampa Bay, that's how many they figured they'd lose into the water down at MacDill Field before the day was out. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, where we don't just talk about airplanes, we talk about the ones that earned their names. And the airplane I want to talk about today earned a name that stuck to it for over 80 years, Flak Bait. Now here's where it gets interesting, because that name, painted on the nose of a stubby, fast, dangerous little medium bomber, belongs to the aircraft that flew more combat missions than any other American airplane in the entire Second World War. 207 of them, and it came home every single time. Before I get into it, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and believe me, we're going to talk about stories today. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back. The airplane is the Martin B-26 Marauder, built by the Glenn L. Martin Company up in Baltimore. And I want you to picture this thing, because it does not look like what you expect a bomber to look like. Most folks, they think of a B-17 Flying Fortress. Big, graceful, broad wings, all business but somehow gentle-looking. The Marauder was the opposite of gentle. It had a fat, cigar-shaped fuselage, torpedo-shaped, and a pair of great big 2,000-horsepower Pratt and Whitney radial engines hung on a wing that was so short and so thin that pilots took one look at it and started doing math in their heads. Because a short wing means a small wing, and a small wing means you have to come across the fence fast, real fast. Landing speeds that scared the daylights out of young men who trained on Cubs and Stermans. They called it the Baltimore Whore. And I'll clean that up a little for the airwaves. But the joke among the crews was that it had no visible means of support. That short wing. They didn't trust it. Some of them called it the Widowmaker, the Flying Prostitute, the Flying Coffin. Every one of those names came out of the accident, reports piling up during training, in 1941 and 42. Young pilots were losing engines on takeoff, and with that little wing and all that weight, an engine failure at the wrong moment put you in the trees or in the bay before you could say a prayer. It got so bad that Congress got involved. There was a senator from Missouri who ran an investigating committee looking into wartime waste, and the Marauder was right in his crosshairs. There was serious talk about canceling the whole program, shutting it down, scrapping it. That senator's name, by the way, was Harry Truman. Yes, that Harry Truman. Now here's where it gets interesting. The airplane wasn't the problem, the training was, because the Marauder wasn't a bad airplane. It was an unforgiving one, and there's a world of difference between those two things. And any of you who've flown something with a little edge to it know exactly what I mean. The Army sent in a man named Jimmy Doolittle, same Doolittle who'd led the raid on Tokyo. And Doolittle did something that settled the argument for good. He took a Marauder up and flew it on one engine, feathered one prop, right there in front of a crowd of skeptical pilots, and flew the airplane around the pattern on the good one and landed it clean. His message was simple. This airplane will do everything you ask of it. You just have to know how to ask. They fixed the training, they stretched the wing a little on later models to bring the landing speed down, and they taught the young men to respect their airspeed and never ever get slow. And once the crews learned to fly it right, the Marauder became something remarkable. In the European theater, the B-26 ended the war with the lowest loss rate of any American bomber. Think about that. The airplane they wanted to cancel, the Widowmaker. It brought more of its crews home than anything else in the sky. Which brings me back to the airplane wearing that name, Flak Bait. She rolled off the line in Baltimore in 1943, a B-26B model, and she was assigned to the 449th Bomb Squadron of the 322nd Bomb Group, 9th Air Force, stationed in England, and later on the continent as the front moved east. Now the name. There was a crewman, a pilot named James Farrell, and he had a dog back home that his brother had nicknamed Flak Bait, and when it came time to name the airplane, that's what went on the nose, Flak Bait. Because in a grim sort of way, it was a joke about what they all were, every crew flying a medium bomber at low altitude over occupied Europe. They were bait for the flak, the anti-aircraft fire. And boy, did Flak Bait live up to it. Pull up a chair and let me paint you the picture of what these men flew into. A medium bomber doesn't fly up at 25,000-30,000 feet like the heavies. The Marauder went in lower, 10,000-12,000 feet. Down where the German 88mm guns could reach up and touch you with terrible precision. The crews called it the flak, and flak wasn't like a bullet you might dodge. Flak was a wall. The gunners on the ground would put up a box of exploding steel in the sky right where they figured you'd be, and you had to fly straight and level through it on the bomb run. No jinking, no turning, straight and level, because the bombardier needed a stable platform, and every second on that run felt like an hour. You could smell it. The crews talked about the smell of cordite coming through the airplane when the flak got close. That sharp, acrid, burnt smell. You could hear it too, over the drone of those two big Pratts. A sound like gravel thrown against a tin roof when the fragments peppered the aluminum skin. And sometimes a bang so hard the whole airplane would lurch and drop, and you'd wonder for a half a second whether you still had a wing. Flak bait flew through that 207 times. She was hit by flak more than 1,000 times over her career. Her crews counted the holes. They patched them and flew her again. She came home once with an engine shot out. She came home with her electrical system dead and the hydraulics gone. She came home with holes in the fuselage you could put your arm through. One time she took a hit that knocked out both engines momentarily, and she fell like a stone before the crew got her running again. She lost her rudder to flak. She had her tail nearly shot away, and every time, that unforgiving little airplane that everybody said would kill you brought her men back to England. 207 missions, more than any other American aircraft in the war. She flew on D-Day. She flew during the Battle of the Bulge. She hit bridges and rail yards and gun positions and airfields from Normandy all the way into Germany, and she outlasted crew after crew, because men rotated home after their tour, but the airplane just kept flying. There's something almost holy about that when you sit with it. The men who first climbed into her in 1943 were long gone home by the time she flew her last mission in April of 1945. Different faces, same airplane, same name on the nose, a kind of continuity written in patched aluminum. When the war ended, somebody had the good sense to know what they had. Most warbirds got the worst fate imaginable. After all that, after everything those airplanes and their crews did, thousands of them were flown to boneyards out in the desert and in the fields of Europe and chopped up for scrap, melted down, turned into pots and pans and window frames. A whole generation of history fed into the smelters because the war was over and nobody wanted to pay to keep them. But flak bait was special, and people knew it. So instead of the scrapper, the Army earmarked her for the Smithsonian. They took her nose section first, actually, and the rest of the airplane followed, crated up and shipped across the Atlantic and put into storage, and there she sat for decades. In pieces, in crates, in a storage facility in Maryland, this most decorated of American combat aircraft waiting. And now, finally, we get to the restoration. Because that's what today is really about. For a long time, all the public ever saw of flak bait was the nose, just the forward fuselage, that famous cockpit with the name painted beside it and the little rows of bombs stenciled on to mark the missions, rows and rows of them. It was displayed that way for years. The rest of her stayed boxed up. Then the National Air and Space Museum made a decision. They were going to restore her, the whole airplane, and they were going to do it at the Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center out in Virginia, in a place called the Mary Baker Engine Restoration Hangar. Now, if you've never been, you can actually watch the restoration crews work through big glass windows. It's a working shop, and the public gets to see history being put back together with their own eyes. And here's the thing that I love about this restoration, and it's a philosophy that not everybody agrees with, but I think the Smithsonian got it exactly right. They are not making her look new. Now, here's where it gets interesting. When most folks think about restoring a warbird, they think about a bird like the ones you see at Oshkosh, gleaming, perfect paint. Polished aluminum you can see your face in, better than the day it left the factory, and there's a place for that. Those flying restorations are a labor of love and they're glorious, but that's not what they're doing to flak bait. The Smithsonian is doing what they call preservation, not restoration in the shiny sense. They are conserving her. Every original piece they can save, they save that flak damage. Those patches the ground crews riveted on in the mud of a forward airfield in France in 1944. The original paint, faded and chipped and scarred. They are keeping all of it, because all of it is the history. Every patch is a mission somebody survived. Every scar tells you something a document never could. Think about the discipline that takes. You've got master craftsmen, some of the best metalworkers in the world, and their instinct, their training, their whole professional pride tells them to fix it, to make it right, to make it perfect. And instead, the job is to stabilize it and leave it exactly as the war left it. To preserve a repair that some 19-year-old sheet metal man banged out in the field 80 years ago and treat that man's rough work as a sacred artifact. Because it is. They've had to be detectives, going through the airplane inch by inch, finding original wiring, original fabric on the control surfaces, cataloging every single component. When they find corrosion, they treat it and stop it, but they don't erase the evidence of the airplane's life. When a part is missing entirely and has to be remade, they document exactly what's original and what's new, so that 100 years from now, nobody's fooled. Nobody looks at flak bait and mistakes a modern reproduction for the steel that flew through the flak over the Ruhr. They found things in that airplane too. The crews left their marks. Little bits of graffiti notes, the accumulated fingerprints of the men who flew her, hidden away in corners of the fuselage that hadn't seen daylight since the airplane was sealed up after the war. Imagine being the conservator who opens a panel and finds a pencil mark left by a gunner in 1944. That's not restoration. That's a conversation across 80 years. This is a project that has taken many years, and it's still going. It is painstaking, slow, deliberate work. And when it's done, flak bait will hang complete for the first time in generations. Not gleaming, not perfect, but whole, and honest, wearing every scar she earned. And I'll tell you why that matters, and then I'll let you go. We are losing the men who flew these airplanes. The ones who are left are in their late 90s and past. Pretty soon, the only witnesses to what happened in the skies over Europe are going to be the airplanes themselves. And an airplane that's been polished up and repainted and made perfect. Well, it's beautiful, but it's a little bit silent. It tells you what the factory built. An airplane like flak bait, kept exactly as the war left her, with the flak holes patched by hand and the paint worn down to bare metal, where 1,000 crewmen's boots scuffed across her, that airplane still talks. She's a witness. She still carries the fear and the courage and the sheer bloody-minded endurance of the men who took her up 207 times and asked her to bring them home. And 207 times, she did. The airplane they wanted to cancel, the Widowmaker. She outlived the joke, and she outlived the men who told it, and now she's being handed to your grandchildren exactly as she was. My thanks to the folks at the National Air and Space Museum, whose conservators and historians have documented every rivet of this project, and to the records of the 9th Air Force and the men of the 322nd Bomb Group who kept the mission logs that let us count every one of those 207 runs. You can find more of these stories over at RadioHangar.com, and if you ever get out to Virginia, go stand in front of the glass at that restoration hangar and watch them work. Take your time with it, because some airplanes are just machines. And then there's flak bait. This has been The Hangar. I'm Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down, and I'll see you next time.